Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Host Tucker Perkins recorded this special episode from Reuters Energy Transition North America in Houston, where he talked to business leaders and other experts at the forefront of driving climate innovation. Now, here's Tucker.
Our guest in this episode is delivering a keynote here at the Reuters Energy Transition Summit and was named by Goldman Sachs as one of the 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. Chase Lockmiller is the co-founder and CEO of Crusoe Energy Systems. The company developed a system to reduce routine flaring of natural gas by capturing that wasted energy to power data centers. Chase, great to have you Path to Zero. Thanks for coming by.
Tucker, I'm pleased to be here.
Got a lot to talk about. You know, you're just doing some great innovation. But let's start with the name of the company. Crusoe Energy Systems.
Correct. So we named the company Crusoe after the character Robinson Crusoe. We were inspired by him because he was stranded on a desert island and had to be innovative with his resources in order to survive. We try to channel that same sense of innovation in terms of innovating with stranded energy and try to unlock value in that stranded energy with computing.
And just for listeners who may not necessarily think about the term, stranded energy would kind of represent generally where you have natural gas or electricity, where you got a grid. You've got energy that's there. It could be flare gas. It could be a market that doesn't really exist. But you don't really have a place. You have the production, but you don't really have demand.
Yeah, that's right. So I think you should think about stranded energy as places where you have excess energy. It could be waste energy. It could be overproduced, or it could be a byproduct in the case of flare gas, and you have no market for that energy, and so it goes to waste.
Let's just spend a moment. I don't always do this, but, you know, you've got a great background. Goldman Sachs names you one of the 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. It's a great...
That was a funny adjective, but yeah.
Compliment. Well, great company with a great compliment. But great education, MIT, 2 degrees, master's from Stanford in computer science with a focus on artificial intelligence. How did you know then artificial intelligence was important?
So artificial intelligence was always fascinating to me. So when I started learning about it, seeing artificial intelligence models work even early on, it always felt like magic to me. Like I could input data, I could train some statistical model, and the output would be a prediction. It would either predict, it could predict the future, it could, identify images in a picture. It could do, you know, these things that are human-like or superhuman-like in their characteristic, but, it was all done with math. And, I always had a deep interest in math from, a very young age, and that's actually what I studied as an undergrad, and that's really what drew me to artificial intelligence.
Really great. And then your background, talk to us, post-graduate school, and now to now, what was your path?
Sure. So I spent the early chapter of my, so take a step back. Going into things, I was actually inspired to become a theoretical physicist. That was like what my plan was. And, I spent a couple of summers doing research while I was an undergrad, both at MIT. And I worked for a period of time at the Los Alamos National Lab doing plasma physics research. And I recognized that that space just kind of, the basic science research space just moves incredibly slowly. I had a lot of energy, wanted to kind of make an impact sooner. And, wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I didn't know really anything about finance, but, a recruiter found me, and I ended up going into the field of quantitative finance. So I spent the first 10 years of my career as a quant portfolio manager in the financial sector. So in that space, it was really about building large machine learning and artificial intelligence models that were trained on incredible amounts of financial and other sorts of data, where our goal was to basically forecast the future price of a stock or a future or a commodity by ingesting all of the information that we had present today. So in that role, I was really always a very large user of large-scale computing resources to run simulations, to train big models, to backtest results, and even at runtime, our strategies consume tremendous amounts of computing power. So, I ended up leaving that. I got really interested in the digital asset and cryptocurrency space around 2016. And ended up meeting a gentleman named Olaf Carlson Wee, who was the first employee at Coinbase. And he had left Coinbase to start a hedge fund that was only investing in digital assets and cryptocurrencies. You know, now there are tons of hedge funds that are crypto hedge funds, but at the time it was a very unique idea, and he was really kind of a first mover in that space. And I knew quite a bit about risk management, trading, hedge fund things, and he knew a ton about crypto, and so it was a great partnership between the two of us, and I joined him as one of his early partners. We really helped kind of grow that business, and, the business started with, call it $25 million under management in, 2017, and ended with more than $1 billion by the end of the year. It was really a crazy year of growth for the fund. And so that was kind of what I did career-wise prior to Crusoe. I ended up leaving to sort of pursue a personal passion, which was I'd always been inspired by the mountains. I grew up in Colorado, and I had always had this aspiration to climb Mount Everest. So I ended up in 2018 going to Nepal, spending 2 months in Nepal to go climb Mount Everest, as I was sort of taking a bit of a sabbatical in my career and really trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. Spent a lot of time really thinking about, what inspired me. And, it came back to, AI and digital currencies and all of these digital transformation things happening in the world. I wanted to work in some capacity within those industries. And as I was thinking about AI, I was really, we started to see a lot of these breakthroughs happen with deep learning after this paper called AlexNet was published in 2012. And, for people that were really deep in the weeds there, it was really kind of an incredible moment, because it was like there were all these big benchmarks that people would publish papers on. And, you'd be lucky if you could beat the best benchmark by a basis point. And suddenly all these deep learning applications were like crushing these benchmarks, improving them by 20%. What was interesting to me was that foundational change wasn't driven necessarily by some massive scientific breakthrough. Like deep learning, is just a multi-layer neural network that, that technique in statistics had existed for decades. But what had changed is that, one, we had way more data, through the internet and digitalization of, many different industries and asset classes. Computing hardware had gotten way better. So we could actually train much bigger models, and we could actually utilize these nonlinear modeling techniques in a way that was effective to actually deliver meaningful results. And I kind of felt like those two dimensions were really going to continue to drive innovation for the world. So I was really thinking about building a business either sort of in the data space or in the computing space. And I really felt like those were the two biggest levers to sort of drive forward innovation for humanity.
And look what you did. You found out how to be into both those spaces, I think, right?
Yeah.
That's good. Really exciting. We're going to come back to Mount Everest, I hope.
Okay.
So let's talk about the main focus of Crusoe Energy is really around using these stranded assets to then power. Go ahead. Talk about that.
Correct. So, one of the fascinating things about computing is that one of the biggest operating expense for computing infrastructure is energy. And this was something that I always appreciated when I was in sort of the quant space, because we would get the data center bills at the end of the month, and they were always kind of eye-popping, just sort of the magnitude of how much we were spending on power. And I had a co-founder, or I have a co-founder that had sort of spent his entire career in the energy industry. We actually knew each other from high school. And to be honest, before I started Crusoe, I didn't know a ton about the energy industry. I'd sort of spent my entire career in the technology space. And, he kind of came from a family of oil and gas entrepreneurs, and had spent, his childhood, his life in oil and gas, and ended up going to Middlebury College, which is a very environmentally progressive school, is where 350.org was started by Bill McKibben. And An Inconvenient Truth came out while we were in college. And that that really had a big influence on him in terms of, you know, his peer group and sort of this society waking up to, hey, the emissions we're putting in the atmosphere are actually changing, you know, changing life on Earth in potentially irreversible ways. And
that's 2016, 2017?
No, for him, this was like 2008, 2007. You know, he ended up in this sort of point of moral conflict where, you know, it was like on the one hand, his family had, you know, been working in oil and gas for, you know, their entire lives and, you know, really saw the benefits that oil and gas brought to the overall economy. But, you know, at what cost is really kind of the question. And he, you know, when I came back from this Mount Everest trip, he had been working with an upstream oil and gas company, and he was dealing directly with this problem of natural gas flaring, where he was having to flare tremendous amounts of gas because he had no midstream solution to manage that gas. And, you know, when I came back from Mount Everest, we were talking about, you know, he was sort of telling me about this problem, and I was really kind of just shocked learning about, you know, the whole concept of flaring. You know, I had no idea it existed. And, you know, he started to tell me about sort of the magnitudes and consistency of it. And, you know, it really just kind of blew my mind. And we started talking about different ideas and, you know, knowing how much energy is required to power computing. We sort of came up with this concept that could we, instead of having to move that gas from, you know, where it's being flared, to a market where it can be sold in a traditional sense to, you know, a gas processing plant, a natural gas power plant, could we instead bring a market directly to that supply of stranded energy? So we came up with this concept that we could build mobile and modular data centers that we'd actually co-locate with these sources of waste energy.
And these would come in on 2 tractor trailers, 3 tractor trailers?
You know, it's... The design is essentially, you know, the initial designs were based around shipping containers, but we've since sort of like modified, you know, custom built buildings that can fit on the back of a flatbed truck.
And are you actually doing data computing there?
Correct. So the computing market goes directly to the source of energy.
So you take the flare gas, essentially convert it to energy, and
correct,
then use that energy on site to power computers to do the job you want to do.
Correct. So I think our big insight as a business was that, you know, flaring is a problem because moving gas is difficult.
Yeah.
Moving data turns out is much easier. So by having that recognition and bringing that demand directly to the supply, we could unlock value in that stranded waste flare gas with computing, computing hardware. And
because you're moving that data through the cloud, you don't have a fiber line, for example.
We actually do in cases where we have cloud computing resources on site. We have two big computing revenue streams. One comes from a digital currency mining business that's primarily focused on the Bitcoin ecosystem. And the second is an accelerated cloud computing platform that's, you know, primarily focused on artificial intelligence. We also work with a lot of other, you know, scientific computing and high-performance computing applications.
It's just a beautiful story of kind of, we talk about a transformation of the energy system. I think this is the cutting edge of such a transformation.
Thank you.
Historically, though, you're flaring because of a temporary problem, right? You're waiting for a pipeline.
Correct.
To be there, or you're waiting for some event for that well to become ready. In this case, when that event happens, you just take your mobile data center and go to the next site.
Yeah, so we're pretty focused on routine flaring. So where, you know, an operator may not have a midstream solution for, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years,
and you
know,
give them
forever.
You give them a financial stream.
Correct.
Where they had no other future.
We call it the digital pipeline.
Yeah, makes sense. It's lovely.
Thank you.
And now, I just in following you a little bit and prepping for this, I see you're really kind of moving beyond the U.S. Other countries,
correct,
see value in this. You're down into Latin America now, right?
Yeah. So maybe just talking about flaring broadly, you know, this is a problem that's plagued the oil industry forever, right? It's not a new problem. Globally, we flare about 14 billion cubic feet a day. You know, to put it into context, you could, you know, that's 2/3 of the gas needed to power Europe. It's, you know, you could power sub-Saharan Africa with that amount of gas that, you know, currently gets completely wasted, no one benefits, gets burned on site. And even worse, a lot of the methane going into the flare escapes uncombusted. So, you know, roughly 9 to 10% of the methane escapes uncombusted. And why that's problematic is because methane is an ultra-potent greenhouse gas. It traps 84 times more heat in the atmosphere than CO2. So when you look at the global footprint of flaring, the U.S. accounts for, you know, 8% of the global flaring footprint. So it really is a global problem, and we intend to sort of, you know, scale both, you know, internationally. The first big international deployment for us was in the Vaca Muerta in Argentina, which...
that was your first deployment.
No, that was our first international deployment.
Deployment outside the U.S.
Yeah, so in the U.S., we're in, you know, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, Texas.
Traditional oil and gas states.
Again, we have global aspirations, and, you know, Argentina was a great market because, you know, it had this exact problem where, you know, they have great oil production, and they have nowhere to take the gas. There's no demand. It's even more stranded than, you know, a lot of the places domestically in the U.S. We actually did that project with a partner. So we have a local partner in Argentina called Unblock. That's been a phenomenal partner for us to, you know, grow and scale our business in Argentina.
That's exciting. You're here at the Reuters conference. You delivered a keynote yesterday. Tell us what you said.
So yesterday I was really focused on AI and the energy transition. And the topic, you know, that was the topic of the talk. And really what I was trying to get across to the community is just how big of a wave of computing is coming from AI and the amount of demand coming from AI and how important it is to basically utilize that as a mechanism to help accelerate the energy transition.
The amount of energy demand that's coming from artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so yeah. If you look today, data centers globally consume maybe 1 to 1.5% of global power consumption. But most forecasts have that, you know, going to 10% over the next decade and hitting 8% by 2030. So that's just a tidal wave of energy demand coming from both, you know, broader trends happening in digital transformation with, you know, everything happening, you know, in the internet. But artificial intelligence has been like a super boost in that process. Yeah. And, you know, the artificial intelligence demand is going to be 38 gigawatts alone, which, you know, it's just a really incredible amount of demand for digital infrastructure, and it needs to be powered. And, you know, our goal with that is to power that with, you know, clean, stranded, wasted energy to, you know, help facilitate an effective energy transition.
You know, I want to rely on your quantitative background. You've talked about it a little bit. As you look at predictions of future demand, you know, I tend to study myself a variety of public and private forecasts. And the government forecast, it doesn't really matter whether it's EIA or even international, they want to kind of forecast energy consumption flat. Here you are talking about something that we all agree is we're just in the earliest days of AI, data centers. That growth alone, you said 38 gigawatts.
Yep.
I look at those projections and I realize they almost have to be flawed, that they are understating growth. I mean, Tesla, you know, he says we could have a 4x growth in their U.S. power grid. Do you have any views on where you think power could be 2x, 3x from where we are today if you look out 15 years?
I don't know if I have a informed enough perspective to give you like how much power capacity we need to add to the grid as a whole, but I know for data centers alone, it's going to be a meaningful.
Well, it's interesting, as we talk here, you see there's action on both sides of that, action on demand and action on supply. And, you know, I guess it's possible that AI and innovation could actually significantly address the demand side. could reduce the demand side.
Well, what's unique about AI is, AI is much less latency sensitive than many other cloud computing applications, which means that, adding an extra 30, 40, 50 milliseconds of latency to go to a data center that's co-located with a wind farm or a solar farm in West Texas has virtually no impact on that AI workload. And that's where we think the real opportunity is that we can actually co-locate the digital infrastructure necessary to support the AI transformation, really where energy is most efficiently produced.
I'll say it over and over, just a fascinating new concept. I really am proud of that. I guess I want to talk just for a moment. Let's go back to Mount Everest. Clearly, I can hear in your voice a moment of clarity, a moment of discernment, I guess, about what do you want to do with the next phase of my life, which is interesting because at that time you were in your late 20s?
No, I was in my early 30s.
Early 30s. Yeah. So, but a great period of discernment. What else? What else came from that?
The Mount Everest, expedition. I have an inherent sense of adventure. It's just kind of who I've been as a person my entire life, and I gained a lot of inspiration. You gain a lot of just perspective from spending time in the mountains. Being self-reliant, really taking everything in, and just really recognizing how small you are kind of in the context of the universe.
You have 2 degrees from MIT, a master's degree from Stanford. I think those would be challenges. Climbing Mount Everest, the most challenging thing you've ever done?
I think it's probably the most challenging thing I've ever done, yeah.
Physical and mental?
Physical, yeah, exactly. I mean, it is very much a mental battle. Like, you have to kind of be preparing for, the next, challenge. You have to be always kind of thinking ahead in terms of what could happen, what could go wrong. Am I going to be prepared for that? Do I have enough calories? All of these, different aspects. And we actually, at the company, we have we have 5 core company values. And, we have one that's, I think all of them are quite unique. But one that's, I think, extremely unique is that one of our values is to think like a mountaineer. We don't ask everybody to be a mountaineer, but the mindset a mountaineer has when sort of climbing a mountain, we really try to channel within, our employee base. And, part of that comes down to, having a clear understanding and a mastery of your tools. If you go to Mount Everest and, you go with ice axes and crampons and, ropes and harnesses and carabiners, but you don't know how to use any of that equipment, it's essentially useless. You really have to have a command and a mastery of your tools to get your job done. The second is we try to breed a massive safety culture at Crusoe. We're operating in complex to operate environments, and one of the philosophies in mountaineering is that getting up is optional, getting down is mandatory. You really have to recognize that safety should be a first, second, and third priority. And then finally, things change rapidly in the mountains. Weather systems are difficult to forecast. Your plan A, might not always happen. So it's important to really have a plan B, a plan C, a plan D, and a plan E in case all of those things kind of, go poorly.
So it really is a perfect preparation for business.
Exactly. Exactly.
Beautiful transitions of what you're doing there. You're in 2 pieces of a transformation that's so new, both around Bitcoin and artificial intelligence, and then stranded assets and bringing them all together. Look ahead 5 years, 10 years. Data centers, probably more prevalent than they are today.
Absolutely.
Artificial intelligence, completely more intricate and involved than it is today.
Yeah, I mean, I like to say that artificial intelligence is going to be like the internet on steroids. It's really going to transform everything that we do, from how we how we work, how we live, how we travel, how we communicate, how we create, in terms of new resources, how films will get made, how literally how everything gets done will be transformed by artificial intelligence. And with that is going to come tremendous amounts of computing resources.
Digital currency, will it be better understood and maybe more used 5 years from now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's fascinating, if you kind of dive deeper, there's like very interesting, there's very interesting, you know, economic and computer science challenges that have been solved by, you know, a proof of work blockchain, namely something called the Byzantine Generals problem. And what that's enabled is this notion of having something that is digitally scarce. So having a unique digital asset that can, you know, be transferred, moved around, self-custodied. And, you know, just speaking broadly about Bitcoin, I think what's always interested me most about Bitcoin is, you know, this sense of a non-centrally controlled monetary ecosystem, right? That isn't, you know, the supply isn't controlled by a central bank. The supply is, you know, fixed in software.
Part of the allure and part of the concern, right?
I don't know why it's a concern. I mean, it's like, you know, even if you look at historical store value assets like gold, right? The production of gold is increasing year over year, right? So this is sort of an infinite supply asset, so to speak, right? It's kind of a, increasing, you know, every single year. You know, Bitcoin is sort of a fixed supply asset. So there's, you know, you can't create more of it, even if you wanted to. And why that's important is, you know, if you look at the U.S. dollar, like if I had, you know, held a dollar from, you know, 1960 to today, you know, the purchasing power of that dollar would have dramatically declined. And
less than a dollar, sure.
It'd be like, yeah. You know, 10 cents or something like that. Or maybe less. I don't have the number off the top of my head. But the, you know, the notion that you can have something that, you know, is going to, you know, preserve purchasing power, I think has existed for, you know, the entire of humanity. And, you know, we've seen this really reflected in gold. I think gold is kind of, you know, the standard, you know, it is the gold standard, right? In terms of a store value asset. And, you know, gold is not used as a means of exchange, right? It's not like I go to the store and I pay for my groceries with gold. Similar, I think the future of Bitcoin is not going to be something where it's routinely, you know, used as a currency necessarily, but more a financial asset to ensure store value and sort of protect against you know, central banks inflating away purchasing power for an asset.
And lastly, your business having these stranded assets matched up with your data centers, you'll certainly grow. You'll grow across this country. You'll grow across other countries.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
No option for that. It won't really, right?
Yeah. I mean, we just have tremendous demand, you know, coming in from, you know, especially like the AI boom has just been been a wild
All
ride.
All right. Let's finish up with that with our magic wand. I love to give you a magic wand. You can use that magic wand for one thing in the next year that you think would have the biggest impact regarding this energy transformation. How would you use the wand?
Like I can do anything with it?
Anything you want.
I would create cost-effective nuclear fusion. Like that would be my...
You would eliminate?
No. I would create.
Oh, you would create.
I would
there you go.
Will it into existence. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I actually worked at Los Alamos National Lab on doing plasma physics research there, and that was right around the time ITER was getting started.
Right.
And the joke in the plasma physics community was, you know, nuclear fusion is always 30 years away. Right. It's 30 years away today.
It always will be.
30 years away in 1960. You know, when they kind of started down this path. But, you know, I do think that we're getting closer to, you know, real fusion solutions. And I think that's going to be the key to, you know, our long-term energy security, energy prosperity. And I think it's just going to be good for humanity as a whole.
I think you're the third person on this podcast, and I think this is about our 100th podcast. You're the third person that has waved their wand for nuclear fusion.
Okay. That's
it's good. And it is interesting. We've seen tremendous investment flow into it just in the last year, well north of $1 billion.
Yep.
We see Microsoft and another company actually contract fusion power.
Microsoft was actually Microsoft
in the future.
Sure. Yeah.
So we'll see if those contracts bear fruit. But I guess two power contracts out there predicated on nuclear fusion. feel like in 2025 or six. It was very near. It's good. All right, one other, cannot wait to hear your answer to this. One other tradition we have is to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of your time, your expertise that you shared with our listeners. I know you live in San Francisco near some beautiful forests. You've already told us you're from Colorado, spent a lot of time there. Where's the national forest you'd like to see a tree planted?
So I would probably go with, in Mount Rainier National Park, there's an area of the park that actually has this incredible rainforest. I think it's one of the most special forests kind of in the United States. And Mount Rainier has a lot of, significance to me. You know, Seattle's where my mom grew up. I've had a number of great adventures on Mount Rainier. It's an incredible mountain to climb here in the U.S. And I think that when you trek through that rainforest, it's one of the most special forests that I've ever experienced.
We will work to that, and that is a beautiful choice. What else? Well, first off, if somebody's more interested in learning about what Crusoe Energy's doing, maybe what you're doing, how can they find you?
Sure. They can, find us, then go to our website, crusoeenergy.com, C-R-U-S-O-E energy.com. They can reach out to us, info@crusoeenergy.com. They can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, social media channels.
Chase Lockmiller, co-founder, CEO of Crusoe Energy Systems. What a wonderful time spent with you here at the Energy Transformation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.